Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 64, The Sinclair Method for Treating Addiction, December 3rd, 2006.
Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast, hosted by everyone's favorite psychologist, Dr. David Van Nuys. We're coming to you from the beautiful San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
What is the mechanism that is going on that causes this craving to develop? And basically, it's learning. There's a general consensus in the field today that alcoholism and addictions are learned behaviors that have just gotten too strong. They have been so well learned that they no longer can be controlled.
That was the voice of my guest, Dr. David Sinclair, who's a senior researcher at the National Health Institute in Helsinki, Finland. He has pioneered an approach to the treatment of alcoholism, which has come to be called the Sinclair Method. His protocol involves the use of opiate antagonists such as naltrexone and nalmefene to decrease the craving for alcohol over time. He finds that the use of these drugs just prior to alcohol consumption blocks endorphins and thereby leads to what he calls pharmacological extinction, which is to say the learned pleasure response to alcohol is unlearned. Our interview was conducted via Skype out with me in California and Dr. Sinclair in Finland, which accounts for any degradation in our usual audio quality. Now, here's the interview.
Dr. David Sinclair, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you.
You're a senior researcher at the National Health Institute in Helsinki, Finland. Perhaps you can start out by telling us how, as an American, you find yourself working in Finland.
Okay. Let me give a little story of how I got into the alcohol field to begin with, which leads to that.
Okay, great.
When I was an undergraduate at the University of Cincinnati, I happened to be hired to take care of some of the rats in an experiment that was going on there. And in those days, people didn't think you could learn anything by looking at rats drinking alcohol. That if you gave them a choice between water and an alcohol solution, they drank mainly water, 70% water and 30% alcohol. It looked like they were avoiding the alcohol. And people concluded that only human beings are crazy enough to drink this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we were doing experiments in Cincinnati looking at this and getting the same type of results.
Now, what was your major at that time?
Oh, I was a psychology student, and I was working for Dr. R.J. Senter, who was my professor there and had gotten the grant to do this from
okay.
the licensed beverage industry. And I came up with my own idea, a crazy undergraduate idea for what I wanted to do for a study. And Dr. Senter said, well, okay, you can do it, but of course we don't have any money available. You have to use used rats that had been in the basement. They'd been drinking before for a month or so, but they'd been down there for 2 weeks without any alcohol. They had just food and water. So I went down there to give them alcohol back again in the middle of the day. Rats are nighttime animals. You never see them doing anything during the day.
Mm-hmm.
And I put the first alcohol bottle back on the cage, and the rat came up to the front and started drinking it. I mean, I'd never seen a rat drink alcohol before. Mm. Been working in the lab for 6 months and never seen the behavior. And I put the second bottle on, and the rat was waiting there and grabbed it and pulled it into the cage and immediately started drinking it. I did this for every rat, and every one of them was up there drinking as fast as they could go.
Little alcoholic rats.
But they hadn't looked like it before. Before, they had been avoiding alcohol, and now, 2 weeks later, they suddenly were showing tremendous motivation for alcohol. So what was the difference? Well, that's when the science started out, and we did a very intensive study looking at all the things that were different, the lack of handling, the lighting, whatever. The important thing was that they hadn't had any alcohol. They were hungry for it.
Mm-hmm.
It turns out that the desire for alcohol, like the desire for food, increases when you can't do it.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, it's true for almost anything. If you're put into solitary confinement, then your desire to be with people increases. And it increases every day that you're without alcohol or without socialization, or for an American researcher in Finland, without peanut butter. I show a peanut butter deprivation effect when I get a care package of it. So this changed everything for our understanding of what alcohol drinking was about. The idea in those days was that alcohol, well, we knew it wasn't pleasant enough so that people were drinking for fun. Most alcoholics are not getting much pleasure from their drinking, and yet they go on drinking. So the idea was that drinking was caused by physiological withdrawal, that you're dependent on it, and you have to have the alcohol in order to avoid going into withdrawal. But yet these rats were deprived of alcohol for 2 weeks. Any physiological dependence goes away in a few days. So they'd lost their physiological dependence, they'd lost their tolerance, but something else had made their craving go up. Actually, nowadays, it's clear that the same thing is true for cocaine, the same thing is true for morphine. There is a general phenomena that your desire for a drug that you're used to taking goes up. So, anyway, this gave me a different understanding for what's causing alcohol drinking. It was something else. We needed to find out what. It also gave us an animal model. We could make a rat show motivation whenever we wanted to simply by taking the alcohol away. And indeed, the easiest thing was to give them a happy hour. So once a day, they would have access to alcohol, and when you give them the alcohol, they all come running up and start drinking it. And then you could use this in order to test various medicines to see if they reduce the craving and can be used in treatment of alcoholism. So that was the beginning. Back to the University of Cincinnati. I went from there to the University of Oregon, where I got my doctorate, doing alcohol experiments with this alcohol deprivation effect. That's where we first discovered that there was a connection between alcohol drinking and the morphine system, the opiate system in the brain.
Okay, now you were still in psychology?
Still physiological psychology by now.
Okay.
And I was about ready to get my doctorate and looking for a place to go to do research. Now, as I said, most places still believed that you couldn't study rats. There was one exception to this, and that was the laboratories in Helsinki, Finland, where they had been doing selective breeding to produce a special line of rats, the AA rats, that preferred alcohol. In fact, instead of 30%, they would take 80, 90, 100% of their fluid from the alcohol bottle. So the people in Finland believed that you could study rats and tell something about alcohol drinking, including, I mean, they were the ones who established that there is a genetic component to alcohol drinking, and then it was shown in humans to alcoholism. So we were both on the same side. I wrote to Kalle Eriksson in Finland, who had developed the AA rats, and asked him if I could come over. And that was 1972, and I've been here ever since.
Oh, my goodness. That's quite a stay. Now,
it was a great laboratory for working.
Mm-hmm.
And we were able to do essentially what we wanted to. We didn't need to beg for grants. We could go ahead and spend our time going where the findings from the science led us.
Yes,
and
yes.
So we could go quickly and had all the resources we needed. It was a paradise for a researcher.
Well, that's great. Now, a couple of shows back, I had a guest who discussed the addictive personality from a psycho-spiritual perspective, and you come at it from a different angle, as you've already indicated. You've developed a biochemical approach to the treatment of alcoholism that's come to bear your name. It's called the Sinclair Method. So what is the Sinclair Method that you went on to develop?
Well, it is a method of treatment that is based upon what our research has shown us is the way that alcoholism develops in a rat or in a human being. I should mention that this doesn't preclude there being personality types that are more susceptible. In fact, as I mentioned, genetics shows that there are some people who are more susceptible because of genetics.
Mm-hmm.
There isn't one alcoholic personality type. There are six different or more. But some people are definitely more at risk.
Yes.
Some rats are definitely more at risk. But what is the mechanism that is going on that causes this craving to develop? And basically, it's learning. There's a general consensus in the field today that alcoholism and addictions are learned behaviors that have just gotten too strong. They have been so well learned that they no longer can be controlled. Now, how does the learning occur? It happens, there are many ways that learning can happen, but we know that it involves neurons getting stronger. A neuron that is used for doing something gets stronger, and then you're more likely to be able to use it again to make the same behavior. One of the things that appears to reinforce, strengthen the neuronal connections, the neuronal pathways, mm-hmm. is activation of the opiate system. This is the reason why morphine is addicting. It fits into the right receptors in the brain and makes them strengthen the neurons. So after you have taken a shot of morphine, the behaviors that you just did become stronger. And it happens that when you drink alcohol, somehow it releases endorphins, which are like morphine. So you've made a behavior of going to a pub, drinking the alcohol gets up to your brain, and it releases, like a hormone, endorphins, which go floating around the brain, and whatever pathways, whatever neurons had just been used get a little bit stronger. Well, what did you use just before drinking the
mm-hmm.
alcohol?
Mm-hmm.
The neurons that cause drinking, the ones that led you to going to the pub, the ones thinking about the alcohol.
You know, one of the things
that's a little bit stronger.
Yeah, one of the things this is reminding me of is state specific learning.
Well, it is state specific in the fact that it is dependent upon the particular environment.
Mm-hmm.
So, if the person is learning to drink in Joe's pub, then that is where he is. The connections are being formed,
mm-hmm.
and indeed, in the laboratory, if we have the rats drinking in a light, noisy environment, and then we switch them over to a dark, quiet, smelly environment, they have to learn over again. And actually, the same thing is true in human beings. This has been known for a long time, that before our treatments came along, that the best predictor of success in treating alcoholics was a major change in lifestyle, in life. If the person was living in a city, have him move to the countryside. If he was living in the countryside, have him move to the city.
Hmm.
If he was married, get divorced. If you're divorced, get married again.
Hmm.
Anything that was a major change improved the chances of stopping drinking, simply because the place where you learned it, the stimuli to which you learned drinking, were no longer there.
Okay.
It's funny because many of these things are bad for health in general. A major change in life is often a bad indicator for other forms of health.
Mm-hmm.
But for alcoholism, it's a good thing.
Hmm.
So, some people, when they drink the alcohol, get more reinforcement than others. This is where the genetics comes in. And in some people, it gets strong enough, they have enough experience, that they no longer can control it. Just the slightest sight or thought of the pub, and they start thinking about it more. And the next thing they know, they're there and drinking. It becomes wired into them. One of the best statements of this comes from the American TV show West Wing, which is one that used to come here to Finland. And there was a character on there who was an alcoholic. He'd just gotten his divorce papers. And his friends all came up to him and said, "Hey, do you want us to come home with you tonight?" And he was quite puzzled. Why should his friends come home with him tonight? And then he realized that it was because of the divorce papers. And he said, "Hey, listen, I'm an alcoholic. I don't need a reason for drinking. I'm wired that way."
Mm-hmm.
So this is what we have to deal with. It is a person who has learned the various behaviors in different situations for drinking so well that he usually cannot control it.
Or
she cannot control it.
I find it really interesting that your approach blends learning theory, genetics, pharmacology, and biochemistry. Am I getting that right?
Certainly. In fact, it's one of the difficulties of doing alcohol research that you can't just be a psychologist. You have to be a pharmacologist, a biochemist, a sociologist. It's one of the reasons why it's good working in an alcohol research center,
mm-hmm.
because they don't teach alcohol studies in universities. In fact, after I came here to Finland, our center here and a similar one in Toronto were so successful that the American government decided a similar thing was needed in America. So the system there is to have alcohol research centers, which has improved the rate at which things could be done.
Okay, that's great. Well, we need to continue with the Sinclair method here. You've talked You talked about the lock and key relationship.
Right.
Take us to the next step.
Well, let me mention probably the most critical but difficult part for most people to believe, although they know it's true, and that is the mechanism of extinction. If you have learned something too well, the way to remove learning is through extinction.
Mm-hmm.
Now, most people will probably have heard in school about Pavlov's dog that was hungry, had a bell ring, and then given food. And after a while, the dog was salivating whenever the bell was rung. It had learned to salivate just to the bell. Then Pavlov rang the bell, but didn't give the reinforcement, no food. And each time he did it, the behavior got weaker, sort of burned it out. He mm-hmm. extinguished the learned behavior until eventually the dogs no longer were salivating when they rang the bell. The brain is built with two different ways for changing its wiring. One of them is learning that we've been talking about that puts in the behavior of drinking alcohol and the craving. But there's a second mechanism, extinction, for taking away what has been learned. It's mm-hmm. it's like an eraser. It's the brain's way of erasing mistakes, mm-hmm. of taking away behaviors that no longer give you reinforcement. So you have to make a behavior but not get reinforcement. You have to drink alcohol, but not get the endorphins causing reinforcement. So how do you stop the endorphins from causing this reinforcement? And that's where the lock and key comes along. A guy by the name of Jack Fishman had discovered certain chemicals, opiate antagonists they're called, naloxone, naltrexone, and nalmefene, which look a lot like endorphins or morphine. They fit into the same receptors, but not well enough to activate them. They're like putting the wrong key into the lock. If you put morphine into the receptor, it opens it up and there's reinforcement. Put endorphins in, it opens up the receptor, it activates it, and there's reinforcement. But if you put naltrexone in the receptor, it sits there, the receptor is not activated, And as long as the naltrexone is sitting there, morphine bounces off. In fact, that is the reason for developing these originally, was a way to overcome overdoses of heroin and other opiates.
Mm-hmm.
You give a large amount of naloxone or naltrexone, and the heroin doesn't have any effect. It bounces off. So if you gave naltrexone or nalmefen right before a person drank, then the person would drink, and the endorphins would bounce off. There wouldn't be any reinforcement, and the behavior would gradually be weakened. The next day, the person shouldn't feel as much of it, and the next day, still less. So this is what we tested in the rats with naloxone, naltrexone, and nalmefen, all three of them, and it worked beautifully. The first day, there's no effect. The medicine doesn't take away the craving itself, but having drunk and then not getting the reinforcement, the next day the animals are slower at coming up for that happy hour drinking. And the third day, they're still slower, and by the fifth day, the rats are not bothering to come up at all. So when we have established it here in Finland in the clinics for doing it the same way, we found exactly the same thing, except humans are a lot more complex. Instead of 5 days, it's like 5 months. But what you find is the drinking gradually goes down day after day, week after week, until at the end of 3 or 4 months, the people are down to, well, about a quarter of them have stopped completely. But altogether, they're down to drinking about 9 drinks per week, which is less than the average Finn drinks. It's about 14 drinks a week.
That sounds pretty dramatic.
Well, it is exactly what you would expect to happen on the basis of the theory for how the brain works and all the experiments that have been done. It's what happened in the laboratory with the animals. They predicted very nicely. And in this case, it's what we observed to happen. I should mention, I've only told my side of the story.
There is another side, eh?
Well, simply, there are a lot of other people who were involved doing clinical trials. And, the first clinical trials were done over in America. We did the basic research showing that it was extinction here in Finland, and I wanted to get clinical trials. A little sidelight here was that I needed to have support in order to do the clinical trials, and so I went to a pharmaceutical company. And they said if I could get a patent on this, that they would pay for the clinical trials. And I was an ivory tower scientist, never had anything to do with patenting, anything like that. But, okay, so I tried it and applied in America, and then in 89 got a patent for treating alcoholism with naltrexone and then with nalmefen. But in the meantime, before we get our trial started, Volpicelli, it's Chuck O'Brien's group at the University of Pennsylvania, had already started a clinical trial. And I can remember the excitement in Toronto when I was at a conference and heard them announcing their results. And naltrexone worked. It was beautiful. Mm. And not only that, it worked exactly as I was saying it did. It worked with the people who drank alcohol while they were on the naltrexone. And at the same conference, Stephanie O'Malley from Yale University presented her results in which naltrexone was given with two different type of protocols. One in which the people inadvertently were allowed to drink while they're on the naltrexone. And there they got great results. But there was another protocol in which they were told, don't drink, and here's your pill. And that one didn't produce any benefits. In fact, it was a little bit worse than placebo. So all of the things looked great, except most doctors wanted to give naltrexone during the time when people are not drinking. That's the way you give antabuse, the other medicine. And so it is not being used properly by most doctors. And here in Finland, we decided it was approved by the FDA on the basis of those clinical trials in America back in 1995, approved here in Finland at the same time, but we decided that we needed to set up clinical work in which it was being used to optimize this extinction. And so what I was describing to you was the method that was used by Contrail Clinics originally here in Finland to treat alcoholism, and the results were beautiful. We got like 78% of the subjects, patients, improving and reaching the criteria for success on this. And that's far superior to anything that had been developed before that time.
One thing that's surprising to me about all of this, it almost seems like things in a funny way have come full circle. You know, I think people used to think of that, well, this is just a bad habit. Drinking is a bad habit. And so we try to get people to, quote, break the habit, which certainly implies, you know, if you talk about a habit, that implies learning. But then we got to
everything
a place
you say
that,
is right except the word just.
Yeah, right.
It's a habit.
Well, we
just behavior that's
uh-huh.
well learned, but it isn't just.
Well, we certainly
it is so well learned that we are actually asking a person to do almost the impossible.
Yeah,
if we're asking an alcoholic to quit on their own.
Yeah. So, what's the difference between, say, a habit, psychological dependence, and physiological dependence, an addiction?
Well, first off, let's get physiological dependence out of the way, meaning that a person goes into withdrawal if they don't get it. That is mainly a side effect of having drunk too much alcohol, and it might be a stimulus, but it's not particularly important. What we're dealing with is a whole continuum of behavioral strengths. There are things that you do that it's very easy not to do. Eating your spinach, you can avoid that with no trouble whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
Other things are harder to do. You may want to cut back on your television watching, and you find it's difficult because it's a well-learned behavior. Other things are so wired in that almost nobody can do it. Can you hold your breath until you die? No. The wiring is so strong on the behavior that it wins and you cannot do it. When we're dealing with an alcoholic, we are dealing with a behavior that is so well learned that for all of their efforts, they have not been able to stop the behavior. That's sort of the definition of an alcoholic, really. It used to be physiological dependence and tolerance, etc., but most of the definition today is simply the inability to control it. Now, there are ways to increase your ability to control things. And we would say it's willpower. Alcoholics Anonymous has other names for it. But basically, that is what they're doing. And they're very good at it. If you made a handbook of the techniques that increase a person's ability to stop doing something, you couldn't use a better model than what Alcoholics Anonymous is doing. They really tap into all of the human emotions, all of the social structure, all of what it means to be a human being. And they were amazingly successful because they're overcoming something which physiologically is almost impossible to overcome otherwise.
Yeah. Now part of what makes
it
so
could do much better if the opponent wasn't so strong.
Right.
If they were not having to fight against a behavior that was this terribly powerful, they could help a lot more people.
Yeah, and the thing
so
that
I'm
makes
all in favor of Alcoholics Anonymous. I should mention also counseling in the clinics here in Finland. We included counseling for people to help fill the vacuum in their lives, and I'd like to see a clinical trial to prove that it helps, but I think it does. So I'm not against the other aspects that sort of deal from the top down to help alcohol problems, but we also can do an awful lot of change by weakening the behavior with extinction.
Okay, now if I understand you, alcohol somehow is involved in releasing endorphins, which then are extremely reinforcing. Why does alcohol release endorphins and eating spinach presumably doesn't?
Oh, that's a hard question. Actually, I don't know.
Hmm.
In fact, it isn't 100% sure that it is the endorphins that are doing it.
Mm.
There was an older theory that a chemical that comes from alcohol, acetaldehyde, is causing chemical changes in the brain that produce something, a morphine-like alkaloid. The fact is, we don't know. We do know, however, that there are many behaviors that release endorphins. If you put saccharin on the tip of your tongue, or sugar, it releases endorphins. And this is, it's actually a rather nice story of this shortcut that the body has developed for reinforcement. Imagine a very primitive creature which is eating food whenever it's hungry. And in order to know, for the brain to know if this was a good behavior, eating the apple or eating a rock, it has to wait for the food value to be absorbed from the stomach and change the blood chemistry and get up to the brain. Mm-hmm. It can be a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And in the meantime, you've done all kinds of other behaviors. So it's a little bit hard for this primitive creature to learn to eat apples instead of rocks. But then this shortcut came along. We developed a chemical dipstick. We call it a tongue, mm-hmm. which we stick into the apple.
Mm-hmm.
And if there is a high sugar content, then this releases the endorphins, which immediately say, hey, whatever you just did, that was a good thing, and you want to do more of that in the future. So we learn to eat apples instead of rocks and learn to eat red apples instead of green apples. And it turns out that this shortcut has been used over and over again for many behaviors that are good for the continuation of the human race or of creatures in general. The behavior of maternal care. My wife calls it the ooh, the baby response. When you see a cute little baby or a puppy
right.
dog, and you get this warm, cuddly feeling, it's endorphins being released. And you can get addicted to maternal care, too, or paternal care.
So are endorphins then part of our...
is another one, risk-taking.
Mm-hmm.
When you're doing that, there is a release of endorphins. And one of the interesting things is that you can treat this. Clinical trials have shown you can treat compulsive gambling with the same chemicals, with nalmefen or naltrexone.
Interesting. So are endorphins hooked into our pleasure center somehow? The things that we find pleasurable are likely to be associated with these endorphins?
If you were in clinic, I would thank you for using the P word of pleasure. Yes, it is pleasure, but that is not the reason for doing it. This is going to get a little bit philosophical, but I think it's maybe one of the most important points. The view that people have had of behavior in the past is the rational man, or the little homunculus that is sitting up in our brain and choosing what behaviors to make, and whatever he expects to maximize the pleasure and minimize the pain is what he chooses to do. Now, this is, if I'm not being a scientist and acting in everyday life, it's way I predict behavior. The way everyone does is looking at somebody else, and is he going to get pleasure from this? He'll probably do it. This is, at least in Western cultures, the way that we see people. It happens to be incorrect. This is proven very nicely in the case of alcoholism and addiction. If behavior were caused rationally, there'd be a very simple solution to treating alcoholism. Punishment. All you'd need to do is to make alcohol drinking less pleasant and more painful. And so you tell the alcoholic, if you drink, you're going to get liver cirrhosis. If you're his boss, you say, if you drink, you're going to get fired. If you're his wife, you say, if you drink, I'm going to leave you. You can go on and give him electric shock. You can give him antabuse to make him feel like he's going to die if he drinks.
Mm-hmm.
We've been using this method for 2,000 years, and it hasn't worked yet. We keep using it because it's so rational. It fits into our belief system about the way the behavior is made. Now, maybe there is some rational behavior. I don't claim to ever having been rational myself, but some of my friends tell me that they are rational.
Okay.
But when we're dealing with a behavior like addictions, we're down at a much lower level of behavior. We're down at the level of eating food when you must have it, when you're starving to death. These are very primitive type of things, and you can understand them. You have to look at the neuronal level in order to understand them.
Okay.
One of the problems with the rational thing is that there is no extinction. Why should giving naltrexone make a difference than just telling the person you give naltrexone? If it's a rational behavior, it shouldn't make any difference. The person knows it's not going to give any pleasure. But let me give you an example here. And I think this is one of the saddest things in the entire area. Before we ever started using naltrexone and treating alcoholism, the idea came that you could treat heroin addiction with it. And there was a huge trial sponsored by the National Institute of Drug Abuse, NIDA, in which they gave naltrexone or a placebo to heroin addicts. The doctors who set it up, however, didn't think about extinction. They were thinking that taking heroin is a rational behavior. And so what they did was to give the people a card that said, "You have been given naltrexone. Do not take any opiates. Do not take heroin or morphine or methadone. If you take a small amount, you will feel no pleasure." In other words, don't bother. It's not going to be pleasant if you're rational. "And then if you take a large amount of opiates, you will die." Now, this does not encourage them to make the behavior at the same time that the reinforcement is blocked. And indeed, what happened in the entire trial overall, there was no benefit from naltrexone over placebo. Nothing was significant. Mm-hmm. But when they looked closer, they found that there was a subgroup of 18 people in the naltrexone group and 17 in the placebo that disobeyed the instructions. And they went ahead and they shot up or took methadone while they were on the medication. And there they got the good results. There they found that the ones in naltrexone tried it a few times and then stopped. They extinguished. They found that the craving went down progressively and was significantly lower at the end. And the scientist who wrote up the article concluded that naltrexone is working by extinction and you have to make the behavior while you're on it.
Mm-hmm.
That was 1978. If you pick up a package of naltrexone today, Revio, one of the other brand names, and look at it, a package insert, it will tell you, "If you are treating heroin addicts, inform the addict not to use opiates while on naltrexone. Tell him if he uses a small amount, he will feel no pressure. If he uses a large amount, he will go into coma or die." They added the coma. I mean, they don't tell him that he has to disobey these instructions for it to work, which the theory says has to be that way, which the scientific evidence proved. We knew how to treat heroin addiction in 1978, and the package inserts still do not tell doctors how to do it properly.
I see. So in other words, people are out there.
A generation of heroin addicts because of lack of information, lack of acceptance that there is such a thing as extinction, because it doesn't make rational sense with the homunculus.
So they're misusing the drug then, basically. They're not following the right protocol.
Until recently, the doctors who used it for heroin addiction were using it the wrong way.
Mm-hmm.
Just recently, there was a trial that was done by people in Russia who, in St. Petersburg, in Pavlov Institute, where they liked the idea of extinction since Pavlov developed it.
Right.
In which they had the patients actually taking the heroin, or they were going to take it anyway, but they told them, "Just take, make sure that you use the naltrexone before you shoot up." And they got beautiful results. So all of the results confirm that you have to use it, pairing the two together. But in the meantime, we have lost a generation by using it the wrong way.
Yeah, because I'm wondering.
There's a danger the same thing could happen with alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
Here in Finland, it started off with Contra clinics, and then the public health service started using it the right way also. And most of the naltrexone used here is used in an extinction manner. And they've treated about a third of the alcoholics already. In America, I'm told that the experts in the field, the pioneers, have all agreed now that it's working by extinction. But the message hasn't gotten down to the doctors. It hasn't gotten down to the insurance companies that pay for it. Let me just mention one other thing here that is a nice new development. And this is Project Combine, which was just published. This is the largest clinical trial ever in the alcohol field. And it was testing naltrexone with counseling and a Compersate. What they found, once again, they confirmed that naltrexone worked. This is like the 50th one to show it works. But they showed that it works even without any counseling. Now, that was not a big surprise to me. I mean, it mm-hmm. worked with my rats. I tried to counsel them, don't drink. They didn't pay attention to me.
Yeah.
The medicine works without counseling. Maybe the right type of counseling can help. I think it does. But you don't need it for the medicine to have a beneficial effect. When naltrexone was approved by the FDA, it was approved as an adjunct, something to be used in addition to a comprehensive program of alcoholism treatment. So this would be, you know, a big alcoholism clinic that has all kinds of other things to go together, and not the general practitioner. Well, the results of Project Combine show that it works just as medicine. So a doctor could give it with no trouble, just a general practitioner, and it doesn't need to be combined with a huge amount of counseling. To be honest, we found the same thing here in Finland in clinical trials with Nalmefen, but they were a bit smaller than the Australians had found it with naltrexone, but that was much more. This project combined with huge numbers of subjects convincingly shows it works without counseling.
Okay, and you find that people who've gone through this treatment can even become social drinkers, which is pretty dramatic.
Let me start off by saying that in our clinical trial that we did eventually do here in Finland, we had a placebo group in there that was, one of the methods, it was a protocol of controlled drinking, and there was naltrexone or placebo. The group that did by far the worst was the placebo group on controlled drinking. So if you're not using naltrexone or Nalmefen, don't go with controlled drinking.
Controlled drinking meaning?
This is telling the usual thing that AA has said, and most therapists, is do not take the first drink.
Mm-hmm.
Stay completely abstinent. Most alcoholics would like to be social drinkers. But the fact is that most cannot. Once you get the first drink, for the vast majority, they go back and become full-scale alcoholics if you're doing it without naltrexone. And it's just the nature of the behavior. It's so strong. But with naltrexone, you have to be a controlled drinker to begin with. When we looked at a 3-year follow-up, we found that about 26% had stopped drinking completely. The others were down to a maximum of drinking once or twice a week. And, you know, it's sauna on Saturday nights, you have a beer along with it.
Mm-hmm.
So they still were drinking socially. If Christmas came along, then they would have a Christmas drink along with other people. But they would take an naltrexone pill before drinking. You have to carry the pill with you for the rest of your life and remember never to drink without taking the naltrexone first. If you do drink without taking the naltrexone, then you start relearning. You get the endorphins being released. They fit into the receptors. And we know what happens. Within 6 months, you'll be back up to being an alcoholic, drinking at the original rate. So there is it's a lifetime commitment to carry the pill with you, but you only need to use it on the days when you're drinking.
Now, I find that very dramatic, and I had not ever heard of it until a listener brought your work to my attention. Why isn't this more widely known?
That $64,000 question. In Finland, it's well known.
Uh-huh.
In Finland, despite the fact that my lousy Finnish, they even interviewed me in English. The message is pretty well known here. And the Finnish doctors who are using it say they can't understand why the rest of the world has not picked up on it. In America, there are places where it is being used. There was a clinic in Sarasota, Florida, that is using it the right way. Another group in Miami that are using it. Originally, we tried setting up clinics in New England, and a group there in Boston, a hospital, was using it. So there are places that are using it in a way that maximizes extinction. Other places are beginning to adopt some of the aspects that go along with this. For example, we start using the naltrexone without bothering with detoxification first. You have a person who was drinking yesterday. With naltrexone, you have to have a liver test. And if your liver is not too bad, there's about 2% of the patients or so who are so far down that you cannot start in with an naltrexone. Nalmefene you could, but naltrexone you can't. The others start in the next day taking a naltrexone pill before drinking. And gradually, over the next 3 months, the drinking goes down. It is a type of detoxification. The person is no longer physiologically dependent, but you never have him going cold turkey. And here's another point. If you are having a regular detoxification method in a hospital, if they don't use any medication, it's horrible. It's one of the worst experiences imaginable, I'm told. And in fact, it can be fatal. So most hospitals do give medication, but what they give is benzodiazepines or barbiturates, which are addictive drugs, actually sort of substitutions for some of the alcohol effects.
Mm-hmm.
This makes it much more pleasant, makes it much, much safer, but you also have the risk of the person becoming dual addicted to the alcohol and the benzodiazepines. I know of cases that have died as a result of this. So you have a very costly process of detoxification inpatient, very unpleasant, dangerous for dual addiction, and the end result is somebody who's not physiologically dependent. When you're using naltrexone, you don't have any of those problems. You have a person who's not physiologically dependent, but you also have a person who doesn't want alcohol anymore, who doesn't think about it anymore.
That just sounds great. I'm wondering if this model of blocking endorphin receptor sites opens up a new model for treating a much wider array of disorders.
Definitely. I mentioned in gambling, which the clinical trials have been done. The professor at the University of Minnesota got the patents on that, and they've done the clinical trials, and they look very promising. So I think there's a good chance that FDA will be approving nalmefene for that in the near future.
Mm-hmm.
Hope so, because there is no medicine for compulsive gambling. But really, it should be the beginning of an entire realm of treatments.
Mm-hmm.
In the first place, there are the other drug addictions. You could use it for heroin addiction in a way that was optimal. You could use it to stop taking methadone. Right now, methadone is a good thing by itself. It saves lives, but you're stuck treating the patients usually for a lifetime. With this, you could terminate the methadone after they have switched on to it and stopped using heroin. You should be able to use it for treating cocaine addiction. It was a clinical trial by Schmidt in Texas that showed that it very nice positive results, and it's worked with animals. First trial from Australia got good results in treating amphetamine addiction. So those are other drug addictions that probably could be treated in the same way, and no doubt that you could treat methadone and heroin this way. But then, in addition to treating of gambling. There are compulsive behaviors like people who cut their arms and or pull their hair.
Mm-hmm.
That probably is reinforced by the endorphin system and could be treated. A new one that I've been working on is the treatment of various forms of eating disorders. Bulimia and, well, eating is reinforced all over the place by endorphins. The flavors, as I mentioned, saccharin in your tongue, are reinforced by endorphins. And most eating disorders are a form of addiction to that particular behavior. So you could use it for treating eating disorders. You have to use, however, a very special method that we call selective extinction. This we've developed here in the clinics in Finland for alcohol. Because there are so many behaviors that are going through the opioidergic system, when you're treating one, say alcoholism, you don't want to get rid of all the other behaviors. You don't want to make the person no longer interested in sex, no longer interested in sweets. And as a matter of fact, that was a problem with clinical trial in Wisconsin, found that the patients lost interest in sweets when they were being treated for alcohol problems with naltrexone. The Swedish clinical trial found not only a loss of interest in sweets, but a loss of libido, that the patients weren't interested in sex as much. And this we don't want to happen. We don't want them to stop taking care of babies and puppy dogs.
Right.
So when a patient first comes into the clinic, he makes a list of those things that are pleasant to him or to her, and the doctor looks at it and tries to estimate which ones are probably going to the opioidergic system. It's sort of an art, but you tell the patient, don't do these things when you're taking the naltrexone. Don't eat spicy foods and sweet foods. Don't jog. Don't go in for sports or high-risk activities. Now, for the most part, the alcoholics don't mind because we're not telling them they can't drink. That's the thing they want to do.
Yeah.
And we're saying, go ahead and drink normally.
Right.
But don't do these other things. After they have been in the treatment for a couple of weeks or a month, depends upon the individual, then you have them have a weekend with no naltrexone, no alcohol. Friday evening you start, Saturday is a washout day, and on Sunday they take advantage of these other behaviors. They have a great meal or good sex or a lot of good jogging or sports. Whatever it is that they have been missing, they do these behaviors. Now, one side effect of taking the antagonist is that the body compensates for the endorphin receptors being blocked by making more of them. And so there is a supersensitivity to endorphins. As long as the naltrexone is there, it doesn't mean anything because they can't fit into the receptors. But when the naltrexone is washed out, and you have this entire new crop of receptors sitting there ready to be filled by the first bite of chocolate releasing endorphins into them. And the patients report it is extremely reinforcing. When we did it with animals, with rats, the other behavior was drinking saccharin. And we actually pushed that behavior up at the same time we extinguished the alcohol drinking. And that's what you want to do in treatment. You want to have other behaviors, compensatory behaviors, increasing at the same time that you're getting rid of the alcoholism. Now, getting back to the eating disorders, you don't want to burn out all eating. You only want to get rid of bad eating behaviors, the ones that lead to bulimia, for instance.
Right.
So you have to have the person take naltrexone, or a better way here would be with naloxone transdermally, to take it when you're having bad eating behaviors, and go ahead and eat and vomit it up, whatever is the way that you're doing it. And then the next meal, after that has disappeared, if it's naloxone, it goes away in a very short period of time, then the next meal is without any pill or antagonist, and you're eating spinach and steak and healthy foods. So we're pushing the good, healthy eating up while extinguishing the bad eating behaviors.
Okay.
It works in rats. This one needs to be tested in clinical trials, and we're at the cutting edge of the science. We know it works with alcoholism, heroin addiction, gambling, these other applications, compulsive shopping, sexual deviant behaviors, and many, many others that might be treated, but that will be topics for future scientific investigations.
Okay. Well, Dr. Sinclair, I want to thank you so much. You've been very generous with your time and with your information. I think this is groundbreaking research that you have been pioneering here for quite a few years, and I'm hoping that it finds wider adoption. Thanks so much for being my guest today.
Well, thank you very much. The most important thing is to get the information out to people. That's the only way that it's going to be used, and that's what's important at this stage. Thank you.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed this conversation with Dr. David Sinclair. Personally, I'm quite impressed by his credentials in this area and his long track record in alcoholism research. I'll definitely be recommending to anyone struggling with addiction that they explore and at least consider his treatment approach. Believe it or not, I've heard from a number of listeners that they would actually like longer interviews so that they can get into more depth. So I did let this interview run longer than any in the past, and consequently, I'll keep my own commentary much shorter on this one. As you heard, I was having some difficulty slipping in some of my questions. Dr. Sinclair apologized for this after our interview, but explained that he really felt a need to stick to his narrative to make sure he got the whole story out there. However, he also said I was asking good questions. There are two questions I would have liked to have gotten into our discussion. The first is, I would have liked to hear him comment on the role of Skinnerian operant conditioning in the process of learned addiction. He stressed learning as the underlying dynamic and used the Pavlovian model of conditioned learning. However, I'm under the impression that Skinnerian operant conditioning, with its understanding of complex schedules of reinforcement, might provide a better model for understanding persistent, difficult-to-extinguish habits in humans. As I mentioned in the interview, I do like the fact that his approach combines pharmacology, neurochemistry, and learning theory. It strikes me as a very integrative approach in that regard. My second question relates to his observation that while on naltrexone, the number of opiate receptor sites increase. He gave the example in relation to selective extinction of alcohol, but not pizza, if I remember correctly. In other words, don't eat pizza right after you take the naltrexone, or your desire for pizza will be extinguished along with the desire for alcohol. Now, I thought I heard him say something along the lines of, if you did go back to eating pizza sometime later without the naltrexone, that pizza would taste maybe 10 times better than ever before. So this makes me wonder if alcohol would also taste maybe 10 times more reinforcing if a person fell off the naltrexone wagon, so to speak, and whether that might set up a vicious cycle of ever-increasing need in some people who might deliberately jack up their pleasure by repeated cycles of stopping and starting naltrexone treatment. Let me know what happens if you end up steering any of your addicted friends or relatives to naltrexone treatment. I'd love to discover that the information here had proven of substantial benefit to someone out there.
You're on the couch again with Dr. Dave. And Shrink Wrap Radio is playing on again. Yeah. It's all in your head. It's all in your head. Shrink Wrap Radio.
Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head.
Please support our sponsors, who are Podshow and GoDaddy. Use the discount code SHRINK3 at checkout, and you can buy a domain name for a whole year at GoDaddy.com for just $6.95 instead of the usual $8.95. Christmas is coming up, and buying vanity domain names for friends or family can make for a unique and surprising gift. Now, speaking of Christmas gifts, you can now purchase the first 50 Shrink Wrap radio shows on two MP3 CDs. The first has shows 1 through 25, and the second disc has shows 26 through 50. The CDs are $12 each or $20 for both, and it can be a lot handier for some people than having to download the shows. Maybe you've got friends or family who you haven't been able to talk into subscribing to podcasts yet. Now, you can get them at www.poddisc.com, poddisc being spelled P-O-D-D-I-S-C. Thanks to all who've taken our listener survey, we're creeping up ever so slowly. We're now at 82 completed surveys, up just two since the last show. I'm still hoping to drive that number to 100 or more in the next couple of weeks. That way we'll start to have enough for some meaningful stats. So if you haven't filled it out yet, please do so. You'll find it at shrinkwrapradio.com/survey.htm, and there's a link to it on our website. And everybody who completes the survey and includes their name and email address, I'm going to send you a link to a radio talk on dreams I gave before a live audience at the University of New Hampshire. Now, one reason for taking the survey is you can make recommendations for guests and topics you'd like to hear. Today's guest, for example, was suggested by listener Michael in New Hampshire, and I'm most grateful for that suggestion. Someone else suggested they'd like to hear from a psychologist novelist, and I've acted on that and am in the process of lining up psychologist and crime novelist Stephen White in the spring. You might want to start reading his novels now, which will increase your enjoyment of the interview when it happens. I just finished reading his book called Privileged Information, and it was really well done, a really well done psychological murder mystery. Someone else has asked for a show on Kabbalah, and I'm actively working on that. So remember, this is your show, this is our community, and I do my best to elicit and then to listen to your voice. Speaking of which, we have three new additions to our Frapper map, so I want to give a big thank you and welcome to Hisitaka in Tokyo, Japan. You are the first listener that I've heard from in Japan. I hope you'll send me an email and tell me a little bit about yourself. Also, David in Stockholm, Sweden, and Pierre in Mannheim, Pennsylvania. To add yourself to our growing Frapper map, all you have to do is go to Frapper.com/shrinkwrapradio. Or you'll find a link on our website at shrinkwrapradio.com, and you'll be entered into a drawing for a free copy of a book I co-authored, which is all about the Zodiac, and the Zodiac movie is coming out in the spring. So you might find that to be of particular interest.
Hi, this is Mike from Cape Town, South Africa, and you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thanks, Mike, for that transition. Now let's catch up on some of the wonderful email you've been sending. I was happy to receive an update from Paul in Ireland, who attended my workshop there last spring. He's still digesting some of the insights from that weekend. His construction business is thriving, and he has reached a point in his psychoanalytic training at Trinity College, where he'll soon be seeing clients of his own. I always look forward to hearing from you, Paul, and I've put in to do another workshop there, but I don't know if or when Chrysalis will take me up on it. Here's one that reads, Dr. Dave, longtime listener. In fact, you read one of my emails online a few months back. Thank you. I had a question, perhaps a show topic one day. I currently train in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. I have to admit, that's a new one on me. I had not heard of Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, but he says it's an intense grappling martial art. We have a tournament on the 16th of December. It will be my first tournament as well as the first for several of my teammates. We are all nervous, anxious, and probably even a little scared. Several guys initially questioned why they should even bother entering the tournament at all for fear of not doing well. My main question points are there any mental exercises in which we can use to reduce the nervous anxiety while still retaining optimal mental focus? Fear, we all have it. Are there any techniques to counter fear so that it does not interfere with focus? I know visualization is very useful. I use it quite a bit. Is there a wrong way or a right way one should visualize? In other words, could one visualize incorrectly and actually reduce performance? Is there a better method, time of day, amount, or intensity to visualization? Thank you for your time and excellent podcast. I enjoy listening to your interviews and your comments. They are extremely enlightening. Take care, Mark. Well, I got back to Mark with some advice from my sports psychology colleague, Dr. Glenn Brassington, who advised not just visualization, but vivid imaginative involvement of all the senses. He also advocates deep breathing and progressive muscle relaxation in which each muscle in the body is tensed and then relaxed. This gives the athlete voluntary control over muscle tension, he says, which tends to greatly reduce anxiety. Other techniques, he says, include challenging irrational thoughts that often underlie anxiety. And he went on to recommend a book. Well, you can find out more about all of this when Dr. Brassington is my guest about 2 or 3 weeks from now. However, it may be too late for that competition on the 16th. Best of luck with that, Mark. Years ago, I was in a judo competition, and I remember those butterflies all too well. I had a very nice series of email exchanges with Johnny, a psychologist in Santa Monica. In part, he wrote, "Dave, I was excited to find your show. I'm a psychologist in Santa Monica. I would like to offer a little feedback. I just listened to your interview with the NLP practitioner, Patty McDermott. I found it frustrating that she never gave any clear description of what NLP is. She described chair work, but that's gestalt. There was some imprecise talk about eyes. It's crucial that you get people like her to be specific. With warm wishes, Johnny." And I confess that I did have a little trouble making that interview as explicit as I would have liked it to have been. It was one of my earlier interviews. In defense of Patty, though, I would point out that, yes, chair work does derive from gestalt, but also NLP derives quite a bit of its material from gestalt, since they studied and tried to model Fritz Perls. And, let's see, in subsequent exchanges, I discovered that Johnny is very involved with positive psychology. I mentioned that I've put in a proposal to teach a class on positive psychology in the lifelong learning program at Sonoma State University, and he responded with the following, "David, interesting series of overlapping interests. Positive psychology is my calling. I'm teaching a pilot course at the med school here at UCLA, teaching the med students to use positive psych in their lives." Fascinating. "Also leading a midlife high achievers group. There's not much good work being done in how to apply the stuff." Actually, I think my very next interview will be with someone who is applying it, so stay tuned for that. And he goes on to say, "Yes, Bill O'Hanlon is always fascinating. Did you see that Scott Miller is doing a workshop in San Francisco on January 6th? Says, why don't you do him? His talk is called The Heart of Change. I'll check the Pawelski interview." He hadn't listened to that yet. And in fact, I took his hint about Scott Miller, whose work I was not familiar with, but I have lined him up as a guest as well. And let's see. Then Johnny finishes this email. He says, "I'm glad you're going to teach positive psych. There is no place to study it in LA. Astounding. I've joined forces with a former chief psychologist at Cedars-Sinai, the large private hospital in LA, and we're starting a nonprofit center for this work dubbed the Positive Psychology Center of California. My best, Johnny." So it sounds like Johnny's into some really good stuff. He went on to give me some good additional resources in positive psychology. So thanks for all that, Johnny, and I hope you and I can stay in touch and perhaps figure out some ways to collaborate. And I'll close with one more email, this one from Nick in Canada, who writes, "Dr. Dave, I'm an avid fan of your show and have listened to every episode you've recorded." Wow, thank you so much. He says, I just wanted to drop you a line to let you know that your work is appreciated. Many podcasts put out only occasional episodes. Your steady pace of shows, each of excellent quality, is very impressive. Also, your sound quality has improved tremendously. I'm glad you've noticed. I worked on it. He says, I can tell it's been something you've been working on. That's very true. I think I've kind of got it down now. Knock on wood. He says, I really like the two money shows back to back. The contrast between Get Rich Quick and Affluenza was very amusing and thought-provoking. I was a bit startled to hear you'd selected Randy Gage as a guest. He seemed like an odd choice after shamanism, police psychology, and other more serious topics, and yet your interviewing skills made him seem interesting and human. I even briefly considered buying his book. It would have been easy to belittle and debunk the guy. I was impressed at your manners, if that makes sense. I was one of the people who, while completing your survey, sneered a little at your PodSafe song choices. Most of the music you've picked isn't my cup of tea. But as another listener pointed out, if I don't like the song, I can just shut off the podcast, as long as you keep the song at the very end of the show. So if it's something you enjoy doing, by all means, do it. A topic I would like to see discussed would be lucid dreaming. When I was in high school, a friend gave me a copy of Creative Dreaming by Patricia Garfield. It changed my life. Where before my dreams were simply something that happened to me, I started to play with them. I actively pursued flying dreams for years. Nothing quite matches the exhilaration of leaping into the air and soaring around. Many people say they have trouble achieving flight. They jump up and dog paddle furiously. My advice, find a high place to jump from, a porch, out a window, or even a cliff. Just make sure you're dreaming. Another thing I've always enjoyed in lucid dreaming is interacting with dream characters. Just who are these people in my dreams? I've discovered, as many other lucid dreamers have, that when you accuse them of, quotes, just being dreams, they get angry and assert their individuality. They often say, maybe you are just a dream. I've often wondered what this might mean about dreams and the human mind. Are dream characters, as Gestalt folk would have us believe, aspects of our own personality? Or do these characters have a life of their own? Is this evidence that multiple personality is a legitimate disorder? Those are all good questions. I'm not going to try to answer them right now. Dream characters can be taken a step further. I've played with summoning people into dream. Because I'm fond of Norse mythology, I've summoned Odin and Loki with varying success. Because I'm a painter, I tried summoning Vincent van Gogh as well. Amusingly, he showed up and said he'd never painted a day in his life. I'd read somewhere that he started painting at an older age. Somehow, I'd summoned a young Van Gogh who had nothing to teach me. Having done all this and more, it amazes me that people can say that dreams are nothing more than noise while asleep. It's one of the reasons I've concluded that dreaming is a learned experience. Those who haven't dreamed big simply haven't learned that dreaming big is possible. Anyway, I've rambled on enough. Thanks for the show, and keep up the great work. Nick. Hey, Nick, that didn't feel like rambling at all. Very educational, and you've stimulated me to put on my to-do list a guest on lucid dreaming, although you sound like a real lucid dreaming athlete. I've worked with a lot of people around lucid dreaming, and not very many have experiences as vivid as you've described. But it's a wonderful skill to cultivate. I have not been able to make as much progress on it myself as you have. I wish I could. Now, Nick has a very interesting website with his art on it. Check it out. You can find it at http://www.nickart.ca. And Nick Art is spelled N-I-K-A-R-T. Go there and you can buy one of his paintings. And plus, he's got cartoons and all kinds of interesting things. And hey, Nick, I see you have links on your site. How about one to Shrink Wrap Radio, especially after this great plug of your website, eh? So with that, we better wrap it up for today. Remember, you can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com, and you can leave voicemails on Skype, where our name is ShrinkPod. Alternatively, you're encouraged to leave voices on My Chingo, and you'll find a link to that on our Shrink Wrap Radio website. As I've mentioned before, my biggest challenge at this point is growing the audience for this show. So please help me by letting potentially interested friends, family, teachers, therapists, and colleagues know about Shrink Wrap Radio. Thanks again to Dr. David Sinclair for the interview. And I want to let you know that my next show will pick up again on the theme of positive psychology, focusing on its application in clinical practice. My guest will be Dr. Judy Salzberg-Levesque. That's it for now. This is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.